Good evening, everyone. Everyone hear me? Good enough?
Yes.
All right. Thank you for attending this book launch. Professor Kogut's latest book, One Amongst Many. I should introduce myself. My name is Aaron McKeel. I'm a course tutor on the Executive Master's Program at LCIT, former LCIR PhD student and graduate. Professor Coker is co-director of LSE Ideas and has been a professor in the department for many years. And this is one of his many books, The Rise of the Civilizational State. I should also say this is recorded, so careful with your questions, I suppose.
We're already planted. So.
That's it.
Yeah. Can I ask a question now?
Please save your questions for the end. Professor Coker will speak for roughly 40 minutes, and then we'll take questions. Sound good? Okay. Thank you, everyone. Stage is yours.
So, how does this work? Ah, excellent. Thank you very much for coming today. It's a great delight. And this is the first time ever in the history of my 41 years association with this institution that I have ever used PowerPoint.
Great.
Always works on the principle that power corrupts and PowerPoint corrupts absolutely.
That's an old one.
Now, I'm going to give you a snapshot of the world very quickly. A speech by Vladimir Putin last year talking about a civilizational schism between the West and Russia. But the West he had in mind is what he called that political community, that political civilization, which Donald Tusk actually identified in the run-up to the Brexit debate, where he talked about the West as a political civilization. Orban. What can we say about Viktor Orban? But 3 weeks ago, he talked about how Europe was split between those who believe that Europe was a Christian organization and those who believe that Europe was semi-Islamic, i.e. light, uncontrolled immigration. Japan, you may think that Abe, because he happens to be a golfing partner of Donald Trump, is a great believer in the alliance with America. He doesn't like what he calls Americanization. He talks about the need for the moral resuscitation of Japan. And he actually wants to introduce a textbook into the schools of Japan, which was popular in the 1930s. Bosnia. If you go to Bosnia, you'll find the Turks are very interested in Bosnia. They're pouring lots of money. If you go to Mostar, there's a Turkish consulate. I find that surprising because there are only 12 Muslims in Mostar. China. Someone last year talked about a geocultural right to the South China Seas. Not geopolitical, geocultural. India. Prime Minister Modi is outraged by the fact that the Mughal Empire is remembered with any consideration. If you go, in fact, to the National History Museum in Delhi, you'll find that the 500 years of the Mughal Empire is largely omitted now from the exhibition. Mm. And school books in Gujarat, which of course is home state, now talk about the Muslim occupation of India. And he's going to build the tallest statue in the world, three times the size Statue of Liberty, which is going to open up in 2021, named after famous resistance leader Shivaji in the 1670s against Muslim occupation. So there we are. You can see that things are happening out there, which I think are interesting. But people like myself are not paid to just tell you a kind of pointilliste picture, give you a pointilliste picture, give you snapshots. We're actually paid, me not much longer since I'm leaving the International Relations Department, to look at patterns of behavior and states of mind. So what are these patterns of behavior? Let me mention three. Culture, not ideology, is now the language of international politics increasing. And this is certainly true within the European Union as well, but it's also true between different civilizations. The second thing is the reference point for advancing claims against the West is now increasingly geocultural. And the third is that we now have a new idea, the West versus the rest, That's a very unfortunate picture. I'm trying to get it changed. It's absolutely impossible. We've been working on this for over a week. The only reason the Russia looks as though it's part of the West is this is a picture that comes from the 1990s, when everyone actually hoped that Russia would be part of the Western world. Mm. Anyway, if you can use your imagination and just exclude Russia from the picture.
Paint it red.
Here we have the West versus the rest. And before you think that this is an outrageous idea that is associated with the late Samuel Huntington, let me assure you the very first article to appear, as far as I know, called The West versus the Rest was the National Interest, indeed a conservative magazine, by Kishore Mubabani, who said that one of the horrors of the victory in the Cold War would be the West would be interfering in the affairs of the rest and basically trying to turn the rest of the world into a facsimile of the Western world. Now it's quite different. The West is now on the back foot. The West is on the defensive. And the rest is now saying, your moment in history is over. And we talk now about a post-Western moment in history for the first time in 300 years. But since I mentioned Samuel Huntington, I'm going to have to talk about him just a little bit. I mean, that's a book that came out 1996. We've been teaching it ever since. It's been translated in 40 different languages. It's the most important book that has appeared in the international relations field in the last 30 years. And we're still, in fact, I gave a lecture on it on Monday. Why? This is why. Once you get the idea of the clash of civilizations in your mind, it's very difficult to get out of your mind. Mm. This is what Gideon Reckman, who is associated, I'm glad to say, with LSE Ideas, wrote after the Charlie Hebdo events in Paris. And it is very difficult to get out of your mind this idea that there is a civilizational clash. And the reason is that Samuel Huntington actually got there first, almost avant la lettre. He was right that civilization was going to be the currency of international politics. What he didn't understand was something called a civilizational state would come along. And that's what my book is about, the civilizational state. But let's just see why we're talking about this. The rise of militant Islam post-1979, extremely important as the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917. That was the reference point for socialism and communism across the world for most of the 20th century, just as the Islamic Republic of Iran still is. The rise of countries like India and China. And whether China has overtaken the United States or not in power purchasing parity doesn't matter. By 2050, China will be actually larger than every single Western country put together. And India, on current projections, will have the GNP of the United States by then. And then we have the decline of the liberal world order, globalization, etc. And then we have the threat to the West as a political civilization. And finally, we also have Donald Trump. And it was very interesting at the NATO meeting in 2019 in Warsaw, Donald Trump, in his speech, mentioned Western civilization 10 times. And he used the term our civilization 5 times. So the language of civilization is also now the language of NATO. And that's basically what I'm here to tell you about this evening. Ah, that's going back, not going forward. That's the history of my life. But now, what is a civilization? I mean, let's just get this on the road. Civilization is essentially a system made up of interconnected parts, unified by certain governing principles and certain cultural styles. Now, we're all familiar with the language of systems. We talk about biosystems, ecosystems, solar systems. The man who talked about this was Sorokin, a Russian writer in the 1920s and 30s, who lived in the West. And I'll get to him in a moment. I think this is a very, very good way of understanding what a civilization is. What are these interconnected parts? And just look at architecture. We are told by Kwame Appiah, professor in Harvard, that there is no such thing as Western civilization. Really? Just go to Europe and have a look at architectural styles, whether they're neoclassical, whether they're Baroque, whether they're Rococo, whether it's the Bauhaus in the 1920s. I can tell you there's something called Western civilization. You can spot it architecturally. But Sorokin also said that civilizations have behavioral patterns and social units. a social unit of Western civilization was the nation state, a Western invention, which actually goes back to the 14th and 15th centuries, but in the iteration that we understand is 19th century. But above all, you have a cultural imagination, which, as Sorokin said, is a dominant attitude towards the nature of ultimate reality. The Germans have a word for it. Anglo-Americans prefer another word because they find it difficult to pronounce, Weltanschauung, so they call it a social imaginary. A social imaginary. And there are two social imaginaries of the West. One is liberal internationalism, the other is European cosmopolitanism, often called Kantian cosmopolitanism, and they're both in crisis. Both in crisis because they're both universalistic. And we're now living in a world in which the pushback against the West is there is no such thing as universal values or universal norms. And that is the challenge that the West now faces for the first time in 300 years. It's beginning to question its own cover story. Liberal internationalism, let me just give you an example of liberal internationalism. 1943, huddled in a bunker in Chongqing, as we now call it, which is the capital, or was the capital, of nationalist China, an American called Owen Lattimore heard a fascinating conversation between two Chinese civil servants. Why was he in a bunker? Because the Japanese were bombing the city. That's why they were in the bunker. What was the conversation? The coming war with the United States. Not the war with Japan, which was of no great consequence, but the real enemy, the United States, claiming to represent the future and claiming to represent a civilization that was universal. I can go back to 1856, if you like, because actually the country that invented liberal internationalism was not the United States, and certainly wasn't Woodrow Wilson. It came very late to the game. It was the United Kingdom. I can mention a debate, the Second Opium War, which the Chinese love to talk about. On the first night of the Second Opium War, there was a debate at the House of Commons. There was a motion of no confidence tendered by the conservative opposition against the liberal government of the day that had taken the United Kingdom to war. And it was based on the principle that you could only go to war over a national interest. How could you possibly go to war over a universal principle called free trade? And one of the journalists who was covering this debate in the journalist's balcony that day wrote an article for the New York Daily Tribune, which was read 2 days later by his readers, saying he'd seen the future. Because basically, once you say that you're going to war for an international principle, you're talking about open borders. With open borders go open minds. And with open minds go what we call these days an open society. The journalist was Karl Marx. And so we have liberal internationalism born in this country in the 1850s, born in a war against the United States for the first time, taken on by the United States in 1917 when it entered the First World War to make the world safe for democracy, and now in crisis. For two reasons, an American president no longer believes in liberal internationalism, but secondly, and more important, no one else in the rest believe in liberal internationalism. And so you have Kantian cosmopolitanism, which is the European Union project. Jürgen Habermas, the most famous philosopher of the day, saying in the 1990s that moment of European self-confidence, the unipolar moment for the European Union, because there were two unipolar moments, one for the United States and one for the European Union, we are going to build a liberal cosmopolis across the world. Nobody takes that seriously any longer, because no one in China or India Japan is listening to this language any longer. It's gone. And yet, the European Union is still clinging to this story, just as people in the United States are still clinging to their story. So, let me move again. I'm going backwards. It's extraordinary. We have a civilizational state. Because the pushback against the West is based on countries that now call themselves civilizational states. Not nation states, that's a Western model, that's a 19th century model. Gideon Rachman wrote an article in the Financial Times on Tuesday in which he contrasted the nation state with the civilization state, the rise of the civilization state. So I'm very glad that I'm giving you this talk in the same week as this article. What is this model? Well, what's very interesting was that the 19th Party Congress, a couple of years ago, Xi Jinping announced that China was a Leninist Confucian state, and that socialism now had Chinese characteristics. And if you're a communist, that's amazing, because communism is meant to be universalistic. It doesn't have Chinese characteristics. And go back to 1968, the Prague Spring, the invasion of Czechoslovakia by the Russians. What was the Czech government at the time under Alexander Dubček trying to produce? They were trying to produce something called socialism with a human face. A universal model of socialism. But Xi Jinping is not interested in a universal model of socialism or communism. He is offering the people of China, 1.4 billion people, communism with a Chinese face, Chinese characteristics. So even if you take a universal ideology like communism, which is meant to be universal, it's now being broken down into its civilizational aspects. Why Confucianism? Well, it's very simple. Communism, of course, nobody actually believes in communism in China any longer. There is a moral hole, black hole. There are people who are screwing each other over, as they're supposed to do in a capitalist society, because that's what capitalism is meant to be about, but not in socialism. So you have Confucian moral values coming in from over 2,000 years ago. It's rather strange because, of course, there are other civilizational philosophies in China, like Taoism, which is almost as old as Confucianism, and Buddhism, which came into China in the 14th or 13th centuries. But no, Confucianism has now been identified as the historical moral core of Chinese society. There are different Confucianisms, by the way. At the end of the BC period, there were people who hated Confucianism because they felt that he didn't put enough influence or emphasis on the individual. And the first centuries, the AD period, there were people who hated Confucianism because they called it unnatural, i.e. un-Chinese. But there's a particular kind of Confucianism which the party has now adopted. History is being valorized as well. The patriotic history courses in China, which the Chinese students I teach now have gone through, very important, about the century of humiliation. But remember, we make a great mistake when we think that what the Chinese think of as the century of humiliation is the European wars, the opium wars. That's not humiliating. Or the unequal treaties. That's not humiliating. Actually, China invented the unequal treaties in the Tang Dynasty 1,000 years ago. And the term unequal treaties wasn't even coined until 1923. People in the 19th century were not surprised by unequal treaties. It was part of China's historical experience. That's not the central of humiliation. But China has been conquered many times by many nomadic peoples. And two Chinese dynasties were actually founded by non-Chinese emperors. So what is the century of humiliation? It's very simple. China was the acme of civilization. The acme of civilization for 1,000 years. And then the Europeans come along and say, we're the acme of civilization. We've had the Industrial Revolution. We are the people who are pushing you into the future. That was the wake-up call. That was the ontological rupture. And so it's important. Two kinds of nomads in Chinese history. Those who come across the Great Wall on horseback, for 3,000 years, they become Chinese. Those who come by sea in the 19th century can't become Chinese. That's the century of humiliation. And that is the reason why the patriotic history courses are now very, very important. One Chinese professor in the New York Times wrote an article last year saying, the thing I like about these patriotic history courses is that it's introducing my students to wolf genes. They're going to be young wolves. And why is that important? Because of a book that was published about 12 years ago called Wolf Totem. And Wolf Totem is an important book because it has actually been, I can only envy this, it's been sold more than any other book in Chinese history except the thoughts of Chairman Mao, the little red book. And in that book, you will read that China has two sets of genes. It is wolfish genes, and it is sheepish genes. And the sheep genes are the Han people. Mm. These are awful people, these traders, capitalists. If you really want to think, who invented capitalism, it's probably the Chinese, who've been trading with each other. They're only interested in the market. And then the nomads come across and intermarry, and they introduce wolfish genes. And the great moments of Chinese history have been the moments when wolfish genes have been in the ascendant. So there we are. And then we have something called, which I haven't put on the screen, cultural nativism. And this is a very interesting idea, but the Chinese language is unique because of the ideograms. The Chinese language is the only language that cannot be translated into other languages. But the ideograms actually penetrate the national consciousness during one's sleep and produce this collective consciousness. And that sinologists in the West, people who actually claim that they can read Chinese because they've studied the subject for years and years, are fooling themselves because they can never think like Chinese. And they lack what one writer calls cultural consanguinity. You have to be born Chinese to actually understand Chinese. And that's rather frightening because it does actually mean that you can't translate languages, you can't translate one language into another. There can't be a world literature, for example. And we assume that there's a world literature, do we not? You can take a book that was written 4,000 years ago in the Epic of Gilgamesh, the very first literary production from the Babylonian period. We can read that today. No, you can't, because our language is inaccessible to you. Now, this is, of course, a nationalist argument, and we can dismiss it as much as you like. But it just goes to show that there is a debate now going on about how China is civilizationally unique. Now, why is this important? Why are we discussing it here today? Because of the worldview. What's China going to do in the future? Well, the first is that you have mutual respect for each other's civilizations. Universalism is out. China has no problem with Western liberal values or European Union cosmopolitan values. These are thoroughly European. They're part of the history of that culture. But they are not for export. Don't even think about exporting them. Harmony with difference means coexistence, but not ideological coexistence as in the Cold War, but cultural coexistence. Real coexistence, because ideological coexistence was born based on the fear of nuclear war. This is based on a real respect for each other's different value systems. Privileged spheres of influence. You can call this the tribute system if you wish, but it is the idea that at the moment China has a privileged sphere of interest with others and return perhaps to the Russia sphere. And when it comes to that mutual respect, we've seen a few changes. There is no concept of public goods in China. There's no human rights idea or democracy promotion or even nation building. Just think of all those things the United States has been doing in the last 20 years in the name of universal Western values. The Chinese say we have no public goods. We have nothing to offer the rest of the world. We wish them well. Let them get on with their life as best they can. And that, I think, is important because we've never had a world system in the last 200 years without an idea of public goods at its center. And the main one, of course, has been human rights. Let me move on to Russia. Russia is interesting. 2016, Russian scientists engaged in looking at the blood samples of 206 children of parents who had been in the Leningrad siege between 1941 and 1944 discovered that they carried a unique gene. This was a gene that slowed the metabolism and made them more energy efficient. And it also made them super patriotic. And guess who has this unique gene in Russia? Yes, Vladimir Putin. number one on the top of the list. Chief of his general staff, number two. Chief of the Foreign Intelligence Service, number three. All his Leningrad cronies that he has brought, St. Petersburg cronies. We are seeing now genetics coming back into the debate. But not, I think, in a kind of social Darwinist 19th century way, but what I call cultural Darwinist in the book. It's not about ethnicity, it's about something else. And then we can look at geography. I love the idea of geography because there is a debate in Russia called Eurasianism. In other words, you absorb the biochemical energy from Siberia, and that makes you Russian rather than European or Chinese. The subject is called passionarity. This actually goes back to the 1920s. It's called topogenesis from others. It's called place development. And the reason I mention it is that these are now taught in Russian universities, that you actually absorb biochemical energy from the soil and you become Russian. Which means, of course, if you're not on that soil, you can't become Russian. And then there's the rewriting of the history books, which is fascinating. There's a big difference between liberal historians like Alexander Yanov, who say Russia is not Eurasian, I'm not Asian, it's European. And the Eurasianists who say, nonsense, we had 400 years of Tatar occupation, Tatar genes, we are Asian, not quite Asians, we're semi-Asians and semi-Europeans, we're different. Yanov hates the idea of Tatar occupation. And I suppose if you look at it from his point of view, your Russian history looks a bit like Game of Thrones, without the White Walkers. Others, the liberals, looked to Peter the Great and westernization of Russia and the creation of Russia as a nation state. But this is what the debate is about. Russia is not a nation state, say the nationalists and the Eurasianists. It's a civilization state. The nation state is a sellout because the nation state is westernization. We're bigger than that and we're better. Peter the Great is now number three on the list of those competitions you have. Who's the greatest Russian? Because I don't have to tell you who's the greatest Russian on these competitions. It's Stalin. And Stalin's the greatest Russian by a long chalk because of the Great Patriotic War. The Great Patriotic War is considered the greatest event in Russian history. Why is it considered the greatest event in Russian history? Not because it was a fight against fascism, that was the narrative under the Soviet Union, but a fight against the West. And Nazi Germany seemed to represent Western values. And that's what is frightening. Not only that, but also the fact that you have collective forgetting now, which is very important. So the gulags have been airbrushed out of the story. The famines have been airbrushed out of the story, just as in China, of course. Great patriotic history courses are there to airbrush out of the story the horrors of Maoist rule in China, in which over 100 million people actually died. Chinese students who come to my office these days and say, what actually happened in the Cultural Revolution? And it's important to remember the Cultural Revolution. I think collective forgetting is something we need to be concerned about. And why is this important? Of someone like myself who deals in security. Because if you look at the Russian National Security Strategy of 2009, you'll see some extraordinary aspects. The Russian military is there to provide what's called a zone of privileged civilizational interest, which means we are there to protect the Russian minorities outside the Federation of Russia. And indeed, Putin says we're the only great power, 30% of whose citizens live outside the borders of their own civilization. You also have references to civilizational fault lines running between Europe and Russia. And you also have reference to spiritual security. The Russian military is there to maintain the spiritual security of Russia. So there you are. And one of my favorite articles was published last year. I'm coming to an end, don't worry, by Vladislav Suslov, Zhukov, sorry, who was, not Suslov, Suslov was the Soviet, Zhukov, who was, shall we say, the mentor, intellectual mentor, quite a young person in Russia. He wrote an article which really surprised people. It was called 100 Years of Solitude. And before, you in this room who may know that there's a Latin American novel called 100 Years of Solitude, don't worry, he wasn't writing about that. He was saying, look, we were rejected by the West. We tried to be Western for 300 years, and you rejected us. So now we're going to sulk in solitude. He had this great phrase, we're the bachelor nation in international politics. We're not getting married to any of you anytime soon. And we're just going to be a spoiler, essentially. Rather like one of those fairy godmothers who, in the fairy stories, comes, well, he's not invited to the wedding, but comes nonetheless, bearing gifts that you'd rather not have. So there we have the civilizational state. In my book, I talked about others. I talked about Japan in the 1930s. As the first civilizational state was trying as a nation state actually to denationalize itself as a nation state and say we're a civilization, we're not Western. I looked a lot at the caliphate. Now, yes, it's a little embarrassing that ISIS is disappearing off the map, but don't worry. Not only will ISIS be back, but there are two Islamic caliphates. And one is the Al-Qaeda version of the caliphate, which is, it's a dream. It's an aspiration that will never be realized and should never be realized. But you will give your life for it. You will fight for it. And you will die for it. And that, I think, is the important caliphate. And we're going to face that in years to come. And then I looked at India, because Mr. Modi would love to turn India into a Hindu fundamentalist civilizational state, except for those 370 million Muslims who are getting in the way of all of this. And in my book, I actually say that there will never be an Indian, I'm glad to say, fundamentalist civilizational state. He's on hiding to nothing. Yeah. So what's the future? And I'm going to end on this note. Well, the future is not... Anyone who knows me will, of course, realize I will always end on a pessimistic note. But then, pessimism is the only ideology I've ever espoused in life. As George Orwell famously said, when liberalism and communism had been completely discredited, pessimism would reign supreme. So it's great. You can be a short-term pessimist, a mid-term pessimist, and a long-term pessimist. I'm all three. Not much long-term these days, unfortunately. Short and mid-term. The end state, I think, three possibilities. U.S. hegemonic position remains. And the U.S. will continue to push the universalistic message. And it will have some success on the edges of doing this. The second is that we'll actually divide the world into civilizational spheres of interest. With different value systems, Russian value systems, Chinese value systems, will predominate. But I actually think this is going to be the future. And this is Ian Bremmer for the Eurasian Group. That we're entering into a G0 world, by which he means that actually there'll just be a global governance gap. And there'll be no court of world opinion, no global civil society. That will be a meaningless concept. The West will no longer speak for history, only for itself. And you'll have a vacuum at the international system, a moral vacuum, a value vacuum. And although, as you probably gathered, I am no great fan of Western universalism because I don't believe the story, I am actually a fan of having some consensus where you should stand morally in the world. And it seems to me that the growth of the civilizational state is making that increasingly difficult. So I've probably spoken longer than I should have done. Just about right. Amazing. Thank you very much and look forward to your questions.
Okay, I believe there's a roving mic somewhere. There it is.
There's a roving mic.
So please,
I'm very static at the moment. So I won't be in a moment.
The co-director is in the house.
Absolutely.
So please raise your hand and introduce yourself when you pose a question. So,
one at the front. And please wait for your microphone.
I would never talk without a mic because my name is Mick. Thank you. Hi, everybody. My name is Mick Cox, the other director here at LSC Ideas for a few years. Thank you very much, Christopher, if I might say so. I know why there's so many coca-ristas in the LSE. Brilliant, wonderful, amusing, profound, challenging, difficult. Let me raise a few problems. Questions, at least, rather. The notion of civilization also goes back to the great A.J. Toynbee, as you know. And Toynbee also raised the question, which you kind of dipped out of at the very end, that all great civilizations become and remain civilizations because of a challenge. And as a result of that challenge, the civilization responds, and responds in a way which defends the civilization. And I suppose you've ended up really with a rather pessimistic end, that there is going to be no response from the West. So I'd like you to maybe go into that a little bit more in the great sense of Toynbee. I suppose the other thing I'd say, I'm not so convinced that China is a civilization in the way that you defined it. I'm even less convinced about Russia, to be perfectly honest. But let's just talk about China. You spoke at great length and with typical eloquence on the question of China. I just don't know, Christopher, maybe because I've been there too much, and maybe I think the ideology of China is now shopping. I may be wrong. My Chinese students also say something to me, by the way, as they say to you, and I say, what's your favourite point of visiting when you come to Britain? And they go to all the other things. They go to Bicester. And I say, what the hell is Bicester? And it's the biggest shopping mall in the world. And now, I'm not reducing China just to that, and I don't think, I'm not trivialising it, but it does raise the question of commercialism and the question of commerce and capitalism and what China has bought into. And it does seem to me that while you may be right at the stratospheric level of thinking, amongst certain intellectuals, at the deeper level, it does seem to me that a lot of ordinary Chinese bought into commercialism in a rather profound way. And, going not just to Hong Kong, Shanghai, but Beijing and elsewhere. I have to say, it's the most capitalistic country I've ever been in. And in a way, does that therefore make it an alternative civilization? 350,000 Chinese students, after all, study in American universities. I suppose the other thing is a more broad question, Chris, but it's just a question. Civilizations are models for others to emulate. A civilization is not imposed, as we all know. It has to be. It has to have power behind it. Look what happened to Carthage when it didn't accept Roman rule. But everybody wanted to buy in to Rome in the end. Who wants to buy into the Chinese model? They may want Chinese money, and I understand that. They may want all sorts of, things that go with that money. But who's going to buy into a Chinese model? And I'm still not sure there's something for export. I mean, after all, we see this wonderful architecture. I think it's great anyway, because I'm rather Hellenic, as you know, probably like yourself. But you buy into the architecture because you think it's wonderfully beautiful, and you want to build it everywhere else around the Western world. So I just wanted just to tease out a few points from your otherwise wonderful, typically, careers the lecture, I would say.
Thank you.
Two questions there.
Yes.
Well, great.
China model, because I think it's probably better if I do that. Gives me a bogus authority.
you're never bogus, Christopher. You're never bogus.
Thank you very much. We have this banter, which is part of the ideas.
Yeah, of course.
Let me take your last question first. There is no Chinese model, but this is the point of the Chinese civilizational state. Mm-hmm. China has never tried to export its model to others. There were Chinese students going to the University of Nalanda over 1,000 years ago. It was the only university they went to, which was in India, which was there 600 years before Oxford, teaching courses. It's the strangest of all societies, Simon Lee's, the great Chinese sinologist said. Because it's actually the one that has absorbed the least from the outside world. If you're looking at India, this is a civilization that's been in dialogue with the outside world, both the Arab world, the Western world, other worlds, for most of its history. Another reason why India can never become a civilizational state. But China has not. But on the other hand, China has incorporated Buddhism from India, when the Buddhists were expelled from India. The only time I think the Indians have shown a real intolerance in their history when they expelled the Buddhists. They came to China. The Jesuits, science, a new book came out last year saying that China was on the cusp of a scientific revolution thanks to Jesuitical maths, etc. But it didn't have a middle class. And that was the sociological reason why these ideas never really penetrated into the body politic. Yes, I do think China is the most impervious to outside ideas. It's not the oldest civilization, although the Chinese like to say that. I think probably India is an older civilization than China. So much of Indian history has been lost, so much of it, that we really are still beginning to discover it. That wasn't your question, of course. And I was hoping...
No, it's a good answer to another question. Thanks for that. Standing.
Which would have made for a wonderful win-win situation for me. And of course, if I'd been sitting your exam paper, I would have immediately failed because I was addressing another question. There's no Chinese model, but this is what the Chinese boast about. But there is no Chinese model. You get on with your life. We are civilization. We were the acme of civilization. You could never be us. And the whole point about the kowtowing to the emperor and getting the silk, which of course everybody wanted, because only China produced it, was you're lucky, basically, to be part of this Sinocentric system. We don't ask anything of you. We don't occupy you, and we don't have civilizing missions. We're not like those dreadful Europeans after the 15th century who don't want your gold. We don't enslave you and bring you thousands of miles to slave markets. And this, of course, is very important in the Chinese tradition, that the Western world is truly evil because if you look at Western imperialism and look at 400 years. And, of course, I have to say it, I like to tell my students, because it's a despairing battle. Well, the English did actually occupy, pass through, uninvited, and sometimes colonize all the 23 members of the United Nations. And that's a record that China will never So, there you are. Now, the other questions. Commerce. Yes, of course. Of course. What I'm talking about in the civilizational state is the regime. As the basis of legitimacy. So whether it's in Russia or whether it's in China, you have regimes that are using history for their own very, very specific purposes. Do they believe any of this? I very much doubt. And if you look at Russia, you have these two extraordinary figures, Ivan Ilyin, who's now being literally discovered. There was a state funeral for him. The guy was a fascist, a neo-fascist, writing about how Russia was the only innocent country in the world against the evils of the outside world. And then you have Alexander Dugin. I quote Dugin a lot in my book because he's so wonderful. And nobody could take him seriously. But there are nationalists who take him seriously, this kind of guitar-strumming bohemian, who ended up giving lectures at the Russian Staff College on the foundations of geopolitics, etc. An extraordinary character. No, they don't believe in it. But they find it useful to put forward this argument. And all I'm saying is that culture has become the basis of political legitimacy, not ideology. And then your first question I really have genuinely forgotten. Oh, challenge and response. Challenge and response. Well, that's Toynbee, and I don't necessarily have to follow Toynbee. I can actually be Splengarian.
Decline. Decline everywhere.
I can. And I rather like Spengler because Spengler actually said something which is very important. The problem with Spengler is that his book has never been out of print since 1918. It's a wonderful read. Who would start with Euclidean mathematics for the first chapter?
Spengler.
Spengler. and it's poetic. But he comes up with some wonderful ideas. One is pseudomorphosis. Strange term. It means when an inferior, sorry to use these terms, inferior and superior, but a civilization that doesn't have full confidence in itself, imports, in the case of Peter the Great, ideas and concepts, and then builds a city called St. Petersburg, which is meant to look like the first Russian European city. But the ideas never actually take. That's the point. And then they're rejected, rather like heart transplants. The body rejects it. And for him, of course, the great moment was 1812 and Napoleon's invasion of Russia. What do the Russians do in 1812? They do something that no Western European country would do, they burn down their own city. And he says this is not his language, because this is our language, a deprogramming exercise. This is a rejection of Peter the Great and a rejection of westernization and a rediscovery of what makes us truly Russian. Mm-hmm. It's a fascinating discussion. I think pseudomorphosis is an interesting idea because I'm absolutely certain that many of the Russian nationalists who appear in my book, particularly from a club called the Izborsk Club, who's very close to Vladimir Putin, actually believes all this. And that if they could have burnt down St. Petersburg in 1812, it would have even been better than burning down Moscow. Mm. And the horror of Peter the Great is trying to make Russia into a nation state. And what the Izborsk Club is about is how the nation state is a universalist 19th century idea. It actually appears in Gideon Rachman's column, where he actually starts by saying the nation state is a 19th century invention of the Europeans, and now we're seeing something else called a civilization state. And the Chinese and Russians are completely different for the reasons that they're pushing ahead with this. Have I answered your question?
Perfectly. I'm flattered.
One question.
I'm flattered. Thank you, Christopher.
Adrian, perhaps from the University of Kent. Christopher, thank you so much. Three questions, if I may. I'll be very, very brief. First one, because you started off by saying that there's no universal narrative, you know, the West is a kind of universal project, is in retreat and decline. But there are some universal forces, aren't there? Like capitalism, Islam, Christianity, that is, you know, both of which are growing strongly, albeit in other parts of the world, especially in the global South and the East. So how do these universal forces or ideas, how do they fit into your narrative? That's the first question. The second one is, could one argue that the political civilization, the West as a kind of geopolitical liberal project, is actually undermining the foundations of Western civilization if we go back to Greece, Rome, you know, Christianity, Renaissance, the Enlightenment? And so is it that tension perhaps that explains why the West is in trouble? In other words, it's self-eroding, right? And so maybe liberalism is the issue rather than Western civilization per se. And it could be, you know, another way of defending the West, which is neither on purely liberal terms nor buying into the kind of anti-liberalism of, you know, some of the figures you mentioned, like Orban and so on. And then third and finally, what about the distinction between civilization and culture? So arguably, culture is tied to, you know, language, territory, etc., whereas civilization could well be, you know, transnational and so on. So could we not make the case, for example, that Russia is a very, very distinct culture, but within a wider European civilization, and that therefore perhaps this is not so much a separate civilization as a real cultural clash, and that all the dividing lines are cultural rather than civilizational?
Very good. Okay, three more questions.
Talk about singing for yourself. I think liberalism is in crisis, and of course, when I engage my students in discussing whether there's Western civilization, it's noticeable that only Western students question whether they have a civilization. Indian students don't question this, Chinese don't question this, Russians don't question it. Whether that is because this is what they've been taught in their schools, or whether because it's dangerous to do so if they want to have careers when they go back home, or whether they genuinely believe. But of course there's Chinese civilization. Just go to China and see it. But I have Western students who don't believe it. And of course they think Western civilization is patriarchal. It's about slavery. It's about colonialism. It's about all the evils of the last 400 years. All of which, of course, the Russians and Chinese see as evidence of Western decadence and decline. And the West has no self-belief any longer. And this, of course, is Putin's argument. We're all involved in identity politics here. But whereas other countries have decided to use civilization as their main frame of reference for identity, we're talking about sexuality, we're talking about transsexuality, we're talking about race, ethnicity, etc., which cut across civilizational identities. And that's a problem for the West. It's what Mark Liller, noted, a liberal writer in the United States who's made himself a lot of enemies, calls the moral panic of identity politics. That's a reality in universities, I'm afraid to say. What can we say about Vladimir Putin? Do we wish to say anything about him? When you're talking about values, you may be talking about, for example, same-sex marriages. Now, it's very interesting Putin describes Europe as Gaytopia. He also refers to the European Union as the hamster. Not to be taken terribly seriously. You can say that that is Putin's... The reason why Angela Merkel hates Putin so much is his vulgarity of speech when he gets on the phone to her talking in German, his intimidatory language, the fact that he's thuggish, and that he's certainly a male chauvinist if there was ever one. But this language, when it comes to same-sex marriages, for example, you'll find in Russia he has 80% support right across the board. Now we get to the really important question that you have raised, which is the difference between values and norms. We have this problem in Europe now with Eastern Europe and the members of the European Union. And West Europeans judge them harshly because they say we're rejecting. They are rejecting our values. But I don't think they are rejecting our values. They're rejecting our norms. They're Western. They bought into our values. They're not un-Western. They're not Russian. They're not Chinese. They're Western. But they don't buy into norms. Can I give you an example of that? Christian values. I don't know how many people in this room are actually Christians. I think many of us who are not Christians, because we don't go to church, might call ourselves humanists. And therefore, our value system actually derives from certain particular aspects of Christianity. But we've never been to a church, perhaps, for the last 10 or 20 years, except for baptisms, marriages, and funerals, and things like that. My old colleague, Philip Windsor, gave a wonderful example of this. Christian values. York Minster. York Minster, one of the great cathedrals of the Western world. How did the monks, when they opened it, celebrate their Christian values? They burnt Jews outside. Because that's what you did, the killers of Christ. In the 16th century, they didn't have Jews to burn because the Jews had been expelled from England by Edward I, 1273 or whenever. They burnt old ladies who they accused of witchcraft. And in the 17th century, they burnt a cat for catching a mouse on Sabbath day and breaking the law of the Sabbath that you should not work on the seventh day of the week. And then in 1988, when the church caught fire because there was a lightning strike in the quarter that burned down, the Archbishop of York rushed onto television and said, "Please, God is not angry with us. This is not God's anger. It's an act of God, in the insurance sense of the word, for which, alas, you cannot be insured." Now, I would say that in those 900 years, Christian values haven't changed at all. But the idea of how you celebrate your Christianity, how you live a Christian life, has changed enormously with socioeconomic circumstances. From going from a pre-modern to a modern, a post-modern, or a pre-industrial to an industrial or post-modern, well, whatever category you want. And that is the great challenge the West faces now with Eastern Europe. Remember 1989, all those virtuous people from Brussels telling the East Europeans how to behave? You have to be like us. This is an immense difference. I mean, they weren't like us for so many, many reasons. They've been sundered from the rest of Europe for a long period of time. It had this kind of paternalism, imperialism, cultural imperialism, which we're now beginning to see the results of. We can do the consequence management, as I like to tell my students. And it doesn't mean that people in Eastern Europe are not Democrats and don't believe in democracy. Whatever we may have our problems with Orban personally, but actually the West Europeans dictated terms to the East Europeans, then I think we're living with the consequences of that now. People should be allowed their normative identity, their history, their historical experiences, their Christianity. Orthodox Christianity is not going to be Catholic Christianity. Catholic Christianity is not going to be liberal, a Lutheran Christianity. If you look at the Kosovo War in 1999, where you have these massive differences of opinion between 89% support in the Lutheran countries and then 39% support in Catholic countries, with France in the middle. Norms are important, and that's what we're talking about. Universal, are there universal values? That's the big question, I think, you're asking me. And I would only go back to what Mary Mitchell, my favorite philosopher, said, alas, no longer with us. There are universal wrongs. and their universal rights. And actually, we have a very good record on universal wrongs, because many societies know what a wrong is when they see it. But rights are a slightly different matter, particularly if you cast it into the ideology of Western universalism. And say, for example, as Hannah Arendt famously said, you can only have human rights if you're a citizen. That's what she said. If you're not a citizen of a country, you can't have rights. Because if you look back at the French Declaration of Rights of Man, from which human rights come, it's actually the Declaration of Rights of Man and the Citizen. So you have to live in a nice European nation state and hopefully a nice European republic in order to have rights. If that's the story you're going to tell, you're going to lose your audience pretty quickly. And culture and civilization, wonderful question, because it brings us back to Germany, the German problem between 1871 and 1945, culture and civilization. And in my chapter on the West, I explain what the West as a political civilization is. Had two enemies. One was Imperial Germany and Nazi Germany, and then after 45 that changed, and the other's Russia, which has remained the perennial other as far as Russian identity is concerned. But let's not go into this because I've been long enough responding to your question.
Christopher, I want to ask a question about war.
My favorite subject.
Try peace.
My war spirit.
Is the rise of the civilizational state going to lead to the likelihood of war increasing, decreasing between great powers, or is it not related to it?
Well, I go back to Samuel Huntington, and he talked about Clash of Civilizations, and of course we can all despise Samuel Huntington, and most of my colleagues in the department love to do so, without actually reading the book very closely, saying, of course, civilizations are not political units like nation-states. Nation-states produce nationalism, which leads to wars, and civilizations don't produce civilizationalism, and therefore we can't have war. And that's true. That's absolutely true. Civilizations are not political units. But countries claiming to be civilizational states are a completely different matter. And you can certainly go to war in defense of your value system, calling, as I mentioned, as the South China Sea is your geocultural right to be the dominant power, and using culture as the excuse and the alibi for aggression. So I do think civilizational states can go to war against each other. Mm. It's got nothing to do with civilization, but it's to do with the regimes that claim that they represent the values of their civilization.
But I was asking, does it increase the likelihood of war between great powers?
Yes.
That's the question.
No.
Or is it not linked to that?
No. Because I just had my class this morning talking about this, so I actually remember what I said. I usually forget it. The wars are created by three things. The first is social psychology, cognitive dissonance, confirmation bias, fear, mostly, anxiety about other countries, misreading their intentions. And that's universal, because human nature is universal. There's a kind of cultural DNA which might encourage you to misunderstand the motives of others because you simply don't know them very much. You've never spoken to them. You've been isolated. But basically, social psychology is, I think, at the root of war. When I wrote a book on the coming war between the United States and China in 2015, I started with social psychology. That seems to me as important. But then you need a narrative. You have to say there's a story here. And this is a historical moment. And we have to stand up for ourselves at this moment. And that is where perhaps civilization comes into this. That the West is trying to make us un-Chinese or un-Russian. That's the story you're telling. Well, the United States may be telling itself a completely different story, which is the story Mike Pompeo told when he broadcast. He didn't bother to attend Davos, but he broadcast his speech and told the Chinese, listen, it's very simple. You're going to have to reform. You're going to have a market economy. You're going to have to introduce democracy and human rights. And if you don't do any of those things, we are always going to be opposed to each other. And then you need a domain, which is gives you an advantage. You think you have an advantage, usually a technological advantage. You can see it in the air, in cyberspace, whatever it may be. Or you may have a cultural advantage, like Al-Qaeda, like Bin Laden. Why did he declare war on the United States in 9/11? He's told us in many occasions, because they had self-belief, and the Americans didn't. And that's all you need. If you tell yourself that, you actually think that's going to help. So is there going to be a war between China and the United States? I think it's 50-50 chance that there will be. And I think it will be framed by the Americans in terms of a desperate attempt to maintain universal values, freedom of navigation of the seas, for example. And the Chinese perspective, which is that we have this geocultural right in the South China Seas. There are seas. Two-thirds of the shipping that goes through the South China Seas is Chinese. You're thousands of miles away from these. And they're part of our system. And Mick is very good on systems, which I haven't actually talked about. I talked about ecosystems and biases. Barry Bazan's work on systems. This is our system. It's not your system.
Mm.
And the language of culture now increasingly defines what a system is and why it's ours and not yours. So I'm afraid to say, I think there's quite a good light to it.
You're first, yes. Please introduce yourself.
Medhi Ladarak, University of Cambridge. In the early 2000s, Amartya Sen wrote a little book in response to Huntington called Identity and Violence. And he was showing that actually the solitarist vision of culture or civilization of individuals was really wrong. And he was taking the example of Bengal, where he's from. But this is just an example among others. My question is, in a world where interactions and globalization is actually multiplying the loyalties of the individuals to many, many different sets of norms and values, is the emergence of the civilizational state not just a desperate attempt from those countries or states just to survive because, unfortunately, or... Well, unfortunately, it's a bit judgmental. I'm not sure it's unfortunate. There is no other way to stick people together.
Yes.
Question.
Absolutely. And this is what's happening in Xi Jinping's China at the moment, because you have 56 different ethnic groups, all of whom wonderfully claim that they're Chinese. But ethnically and ancestrally, they're probably not. This is a point that Martin Jakes makes in his book, Why China Will Rule the World, which is now the most popular book, it has been for a long time in China. All my Chinese students have read this book. It's an absolutely essential read. But what happens when you have religious identities that do not allow that assimilation? Because a Muslim may feel some affinity with the Ummah, a Christian may feel some affinity with the larger Christian world, and a Buddhist, Tibetan Buddhist, well, he won't feel affinity with the larger world, but he certainly will with Tibetan culture. And this is why the Chinese government, and Xi Jinping in particular, has been totally intolerant about religious differences. And we've seen what's happening with the Uyghurs, etc., and Tibetans. And the Christians are next on the list. Because I think at the last reckoning, there are 400 million Christians in China, most of them Pentecostalists, some of them Catholics. I don't see that Xi Jinping can keep his hands off them indefinitely. Because he will respect, he will think that they have divided loyalties. And that's, but Martin Jakes makes this point, before we are very critical of China for this, China has actually done something that no other civilization has done, which is assimilation. Christians didn't do that. Roman Empire didn't do that. It is a secret. It's the strength of Chinese civilization. It makes it different from every other civilization. It's quite extraordinarily successful. But whether you need to go into persecution of the kind that Xi Jinping does, who doesn't like, of course, any difference of opinion at all, whether it's religious or not, is another matter. Essentialism is what you're getting to. And I think this is the point that was the main attack, or should be the main attack on Huntington, that he thought the civilizations were essentialists. So Western civilization is essentially a Christian civilization. Christianity has only been there for 900 years. of Western civilization is much older than Christianity. If you're looking at Europe, the European Union has this problem, because under Giscard d'Estaing and others, there was this attempt to say the European Union is a Christian project. But it's very difficult to say that, because if you look at Christianity and where it started in the Roman Empire, then the most Christian country was Turkey, and part of the Levant, etc. And the Christian countries that we now associate with the European Union were Christian very late. And this is part of the valorization of history, as I define it. So, yes, I gave a lecture. One or two people in the audience here who heard my lecture on Monday, and I'll just repeat what I said. There's a wonderful novel by Gore Vidal called Creation. And in this book, there's a Persian ambassador who has fallen foul with the Persian King of Kings and has been exiled to the most remote, horrible place, Greece, Athens, where he has to endure these interminable tragedies every night and morning, and has to talk to these very boring people called philosophers. But he makes the acquaintance of Socrates, and he feels sorry for him. The guy has hardly got any clothes on him. He's not making any money out of being a philosopher. So he gets him to paint the wall of his house. It's a nice gesture on the part of the Persian ambassador, but he doesn't want to engage into any discussion with him. Because this is a guy who's actually spoken to the Buddha when he was in India, and to Confucius, because they all lived at the same time. And Gore Vidal's point is, look, Europe is not an essentialist civilization. The Greeks got their alphabet from the Phoenicians, they got their mathematics from Babylon, they got their mythology from Babylon. But they westernized it in the sense that they created something that was uniquely Greek, including tragedy, and including sustained philosophical thinking of a certain abstract kind. Gore Vidal is not very popular, of course, with the general public, but I rather like him. He was once asked, Mr. Vidal, was your first sexual experience homosexual or heterosexual? To which he replied, oh, I'm sorry, I was too embarrassed at the time to ask. So Hugo Vidal was a gadfly who liked to annoy his audiences. And that's why he wrote this book, to say to the West, you are a mongrelized, bastardized society. But that's part of your strength. That is the strength of Western civilization, and every civilization, that it imports foreign gods, foreign ideas, etc., etc. And the Roman Empire, of course, it was wonderful because you had 48,000 miles of roads. And those roads enabled people to move from east to west, etc. China had 13,000 miles of roads under the Han Empire, apparently. So in road building, the West was rather
wonderful. Yes, you've been patient.
Will we be coming to an end soon?
We still have some time.
We still have some time. You're doing
5 minutes, I think.
I once found myself.
Shall we take some questions together, yes?
Yes,
yeah, good idea.
Can I just say, I once found myself in Sweden after a very heavy night, the night before.
Sweden.
And I had to give a talk. And I said to the chair, how many minutes do I have? I've got 15 minutes. So after a few minutes later, I said, how many more minutes do I have? You've got 13 minutes. Oh, this is dreadful. I thought it would be 7 minutes and 5 minutes. So I was in a rather wretched state. But I'm actually sober today.
You're using up your time. Okay. Question here, question there. Here. If I can do 5.
Yeah, 5.
Okay,
and
here.
Call it a day. Yes.
There we are.
Yes. Fully right.
There we go.
I was just wondering whether you would define Iran post-1979 as an attempt to set up a civilizational state, if you deem it to have been successful, and as a follow-on from that, what determines the strength or success of a civilizational state, or is it just the mere survival of one?
Thank you.
I want to ask a question, how to think about the civilization state in the context of global capitalism. Because in the context of global capitalism, the product cannot be made only by one country. Just imagine an iPhone or a Boeing airplane. It have to make some parts, some components in China or in India to compose in different countries. So,
yeah,
it's my question.
Thank you.
red shirt here, this man here, or this one either.
Hi, my name is Ona Bergman. I'm a teaching fellow at LSC. I had a question regarding the sustainability of these civilizational states. In the case of Russia, I certainly see elites who want to produce a discourse, which is the civilizational discourse. But then, is this really a political reality in Russia? And to what extent is this reality sustainable if one day the existing elites, they can't keep the power because of economic difficulties? Would the idea of Russian civilizational state will go away, or will it be something more permanent?
Mm-hmm. You? Right there. Yes.
Hi, I'm Hugo Markevich, second year undergrad student. My question is about the European Union and its survival, because there's a lot of reluctance about an ever closer union. And as I was born without the idea of a border, it really bothers me to think that there will be borders in the future. And in parallel, how about the African people who carry a European legacy despite themselves?
Two questions there. Okay, and last question at the front.
Thank you very much. My name is Paul Carroll. I have a more practical question, so I'm going to address your pessimism, your short-term and medium-term pessimism. Do you see this playing out in the short and medium-term future as a dissolution of international multilateral institutions, perhaps like the United Nations or the World Trade Organization? And related to this gentleman's question about components being made in many countries, how do you see that practically in terms of international trade, autarky, protectionism, and tariff wars?
Yep. Very good.
Okay, I'll try to be relatively brief with each of these. First of all, Iran is a very fascinating. Now, my publishers insisted I take out the chapter on Iran and Turkey, which is rather annoying, because the chapter on Iran was explaining how the Shah was trying to make Iran into a civilizational state in the last 2 years, when he had to put some distance between himself and the West fairly quickly. He was talking about Aryanization. He was talking about the Iranians as an Aryan people, non-Semitic people, not part of the Arab Middle East. That was actually a discourse that was shaping up. And then you get, of course, the Iranian Revolution. And with that, you have a regime that rejects the idea of Iranian civilization and talks about itself as an Islamic republic, with everything that follows from that. So it's a very, very interesting point where a country comes near to calling itself a civilizational state and doesn't. In Turkey, you have one man who's pushing this, and that's Erdogan, for his reasons. But that's a different matter. Now, the second question was on global capitalism, which was a mixed point as well. Well, another Cox, Robert Cox, more your type of person than mine, I think. Maybe.
Sometimes.
Yes.
and he's also not with us any longer. So.
Oh, really?
No, he died a couple of years ago. Oh. Somebody wrote me a commiseration letter, and I said, Ron Cox.
Foxes and Kings. As we
well, we're all, well anyway. We're all over the place. Sorry about that.
Robert Cox talks about dual civilizational ship. He talked about a dual civilizational ship. But if you are one of those people who haunt the airport lounges of the world, and you spend most of your time in an airport lounge crossing the world, you have dual civilizations. Yes, you're British or French or whatever. You may consider yourself Western or Iranian or Chinese, but you're also, of course, a nomad. You're a commercial nomad, a person without citizenship and without identity of these kinds. Susan Strange, one of the great characters of my department, also said, when we talk about civilization, she wrote an article, we shouldn't talk about Ur and Babylon and Egypt to the Middle Kingdom. We should actually talk about businessmen and capitalism. Because this is the real civilization that is shaping up. Mm. The problem with all this was part of the globalization debate. Mm. And just as globalizers got it wrong about geography, with these wonderful articles, like the famous Economist picture, distance has been abolished. Tell that to Russians. We don't obviously do believe in distance. She also, I'm afraid to say, got that wrong as well. People have identities, and it doesn't actually matter whether it's identity, politics, whether it's sexuality, ethnicity, race, whatever it might possibly be. Identities always trump, I think, these kind of global economic ideas, except for the super rich, who probably do have this idea that they are beyond identities. They don't need identities anymore. But they're not running countries. They may be pushing pushing regimes, they may be propping up regimes, but they're not actually running countries. And when it comes to war, the question that was asked, when it comes to war, I always tell my students economics has never, ever stopped a war. Identities, reputations, honor, all those things Thucydides talks about are important. And different cultures, of course, define honor and reputation in different ways. But everybody ultimately wants respect. And that's the important reason for war. Now, I was asked about Russia. I rather embarrassed myself. Should I tell you this story? I was at a conference the other day, and I told a story about Vladimir Putin. I said he'd been in Moscow a few months ago, and he told a congregation of bishops from the Russian church that war with the West was coming. It was inevitable. And yes, it would end up in nuclear war. But that was okay because the Russians, being a people of faith, would go to heaven, and Westerners, who didn't believe in anything, would go to hell. As he said, actually, part of it, they won't have time to repent. That's the problem. If you've only got 4 minutes warning of a missile that's waiting, you won't have time to repent. Anyway, a prominent Russian participant sent me an email saying, I like most of your talk, but you got that story completely wrong. First of all, it wasn't a bunch of bishops, it was the Valdai Conference. Secondly, the bishops have actually expressed some concern about this. And thirdly, it was actually a joke. So my credibility has completely been destroyed this evening. But he said otherwise, everything you said was absolutely right. Fine. So, I understand perfectly that politicians of all hues, even in democracies, particularly in democracies perhaps, use stories for their own purposes and don't always buy their stories. But I will say one thing, that the more you tell yourself a story, or even worse, the more you tell other people stories, so you don't actually overhear what you're telling other people and realize you don't actually believe what you're telling people, the more they find themselves imprisoned in those stories. Which reminds me of the first joke that we know from Oscar Wilde, who found himself in Oxford in his first year in a lecture. And Walter Pater, a very famous Oxford Don at the time, was droning on. And Oscar Wilde was talking to his friend next to him. And Pater said, stop. And he said, you, sir, at the back. Yes, you. Can you hear what I'm saying? And Oscar Wilde yawned and said, I'm afraid we can overhear you. So it's very important that you actually overhear what you're telling other people. Because otherwise you find yourself imprisoned in the past. Historical forgetfulness, as David Reif, Susan Sontag's son, wrote a book about this a couple of years ago, is extremely important. You should forget periods of your history. But you should forget the unimportant periods of your history and remember the important periods of your history. But who's doing the memorizing for you? That's the problem. Who's doing the selection? And as Susan Sontag famously said, devotion to the past is the worst form of unrequited love. Because the past doesn't love you, even though you may love the past. So we're playing with history here, and it's dangerous. And this is how wars begin, playing with history. We get to the last two, not before time, from my point of view, sorry. Africa, Europe without borders. I think that was your question, Europe without borders. And I had a wonderful answer to your question, but I've completely forgotten what it was now, unfortunately. But there was an answer. Europe without borders. Well, Europe's a story. It's a narrative. It's a tale that Europeans have told themselves. And I'll tell you a wonderful European story, which is a story the British can't tell themselves. Mm. It's the Battle of Verdun. It's 1916. It's Mitterrand and Kohl standing on the battlefield, hand in hand, in the rain. It's pouring down on them. And this battle is now remembered in French and German schools, not as a French victory or a German defeat, but as a European catastrophe. When we tried to remember the Battle of the Somme 2 years ago, and then Passchendaele, we couldn't frame it within a European frame of reference. So it was meaningless loss of life, a national catastrophe, a disaster. But the important thing, I think, and the positive thing, is to reframe these historical stories, not as meaningless, but as positive, that you've learned something from it, and you've retold the story. The British have not been able to do that with their history, which is one of the reasons we're leaving the European Union, I'm afraid. And the French and Germans have. But there are other parties now in Europe that want to tell other stories. That's the point. And the battle for the European soul has now begun. And I remember a student of mine whose father was actually the last Christian Democratic foreign minister of Italy. One of his projects, his father's projects, was to have a European history textbook. But of course, being British, I thought that a European history textbook is probably not the way to actually tell that story. And we had difficulties with Michael Gove when he was Education Secretary, wanting a British textbook of history, and everyone shot him down. So there's a lot, I think, the Europeans are fighting a big battle here to re-engage with the European idea. Yeah. And they're going to have to be more imaginative, perhaps, than some of the people in Brussels at the moment, who I don't see the most imaginative. So. And then the United Nations, which is, you know, multilateralism. The whole idea of the civilizational state is based, I think, on multipolarity. That you have a bunch of civilizational states sitting around the table doing deals, perhaps carving up the world into spheres of influence, perhaps not. Multilateralism is non-civilizational. It is based on the idea that you cut across these affinities, elective or otherwise, whether they're civilizational or religious or whatever it might possibly be, which Adrian brings me back to the question I didn't answer about Islam and the caliphate. And I think one of the reasons so many young people went and fought for the caliphate was it was a very seductive idea that you were breaking out of a nation-state system, which has been a disaster for the Middle East, maybe because these nation-states are not real, as my colleague Fawaz Gurgis likes to call them. It's an estate system. It's not a state system. The Mubarak estate, the Gaddafi estate, the Assad estate, the Saddam Hussein estate, the Erdogan estate. It's not a state system at all. It's an estate system. And some of those families have collapsed, and some of those families are still in power. And the Assad family is obviously in power for some time to come at the moment. So my thesis would be that multilateralism is struggling at the moment, and multipolarity is fine. And there are a lot of people who think multipolarity is okay. But that brings me to the G0 world, because multipolarity is not about values at the end of the day. It's about deal-making and the avoidance of war. And perhaps that's the most important challenge of all, the avoidance of war. But there are more things to do in life than just avoid war in terms of social and economic equality, etc., etc. So I think we're setting our ambitions in a very limited way. I do think I should stop because I've trespassed on everyone's good nature long enough to talk.
Well, okay. I would like to thank LC Ideas for hosting this. I would like to thank the audience for joining us. And I would also like to thank the professor for his talk.
Thank you.